Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 30 for Tuesday, December 22nd. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me...
Dominic Rabbi.
Ben Snitkoff.
And David Liu.
So we have three interesting stories for you, as we always do. Despite the holidays, the legal news keeps coming. So this week we're going to cover jurors, Facebook, and Wikipedia. SciStar has returned to our story list again, and I don't think they're ever going to leave. And finally, an Ohio Supreme Court case on search and seizure and cell phones. So let's get into this first case here. It's actually a series of stories that sort of combine into one. The ABA Journal came out with an article this week which discussed two separate cases which involved jurors using Wikipedia, or at least consulting Wikipedia, for explanations of scientific terms that were discussed during a trial. And also, separately, a second story covered or discussed that five jurors had Facebooked each other during the trial, and the attorneys in the case were seeking to get a new trial out of it. Actually, in the first case, too, where the jurors had consulted Wikipedia, the Court of Appeals had completely overturned a murder conviction in that circumstance. So, just for a point of curiosity, we're now in a new world where we can research things almost instantaneously, whether we're on our cell phones or on laptop computers in a courthouse, and if we're jurors, when we go home and get access to those types of things. Why is it that courts might be concerned with jurors researching scientific terms or things that they didn't quite understand that they heard during a trial?
First thing I want to touch on is what the ABA is. You said ABA, that's the American Bar Association. It's a national association for lawyers. It's not required that any lawyer be a part of it, but a lot of lawyers are. The reason why, and to now answer your question, the reason why courts are concerned with this is because it's the job of the jury to find the facts as they're presented in the case. And if you do research on Wikipedia, or if you, you know, go to the library and you look up a law or cases surrounding the law, you're making a decision based on stuff that wasn't presented to you at trial. And that's worrisome because, you know, who knows what you're going to find online? Who knows whether or not that information is accurate, especially from a source from Wikipedia that can be edited by anyone. So, you know, it's the job of the judge to make sure that all of the evidence that comes in and all of the law that the jury is instructed on is as accurate as it can be.
But what if the attorneys that are presenting or the witnesses, which are being elicited to, you know, submit testimony by the attorneys in the case, what if the information that's coming at the jurors is incorrect, though, or they suspect it to be incorrect, or they just don't fully understand it, and they feel like it might be something that's essential in the case to make a decision?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tougher question when the lawyers aren't fully explaining or when the witnesses aren't fully explaining what's going on. Some judges allow the jury to ask the witnesses questions. The other thing they could do is send a note to the judge saying, listen, judge, we don't understand what's going on. Can you have, you know, the lawyers try to clarify this for us? Or the witnesses try to clarify it for us? It's just, it hurts the judicial system when these people go out and do their own research on this because, like I said, you just don't know whether or not that's accurate.
I mean, it's completely feasible for clever counsel to realize the jurors might be looking at Wikipedia and then go edit the page strategically while they go and deliberate and then make it so it goes perfectly for their client.
And I mean, I'm sure there's no actual legal recourse for it, but editing Wikipedia for an article somewhat related to what you are, I mean, there's a conflict of interest there that Wikipedia would probably disallow through their conflict of interest rules.
Oh, right. You mean the attorneys, if they were to go to the Wikipedia and actually edit the pages themselves? Yeah, that would certainly raise a number of ethical implications that under which the attorneys that in the case could be sanctioned. And I'm sure, you know, at the bottom of that list is probably Wikipedia's conflict of interest policy, but also notable, I suppose. So
I mean, I suppose there's two cases there. There's the one case where they're editing something related to their case, like, you know, the Wikipedia page on blood spatter, and, you know, if they put something on the top there that says this is often used to convict criminals of, you know, wrongdoing somehow, I mean, that's sure to bias anyone reading the results. But then I guess it would be more direct conflict of interest if they were editing the page about the case itself, if it were high profile enough to have its own Wikipedia page.
Right, that would certainly be another concern.
Yeah, or one of the...
I think one of the... I'm sorry, Ben, you can go ahead.
Or one of the parties editing the page of one of the other parties. You know, if it's a criminal case, if the prosecutor went in and, you know, edited the Wikipedia page of O.J. Simpson during the case, you know, O.J. Simpson is a murderer, that would be libel, in addition to probably a violation of attorney's professional responsibility. But you go. Yeah, David.
Right. I think another thing which sort of underlines the principle which is being applied here is the fact that the way that the adversarial legal system, which is sort of the core of how our legal system operates, how that is intended to work is that two people or two separate parties come into the courtroom and they present their sides of the case. And the way that it functions, it sort of forces both the parties to do their best to explain their side of the case. And if they fall short of that by not giving good explanations, they're sort of doing it at their own peril. And so, you know, a well-practiced trial attorney or a witness, at least, should be made to give it the fullest explanation as possible so that the jury can understand those things. And if they don't, that's sort of their problem. And we certainly don't want jurors going off to Wikipedia, which is anyone can edit it. And stuff in there is not always accurate either. So external sources are never good. Now, going on to the second part of our story here, which is this other case that involved five jurors which had Facebooked each other. In that case, I believe the judge had even given an order to the jury not to communicate with each other outside of the courtroom. So why then, how does this differ at all, if it does, from the Wikipedia case that went on? And why don't we want jurors communicating with each other outside of the courthouse?
Before we go on to that, I think it might be helpful if we elaborate a little bit why it's, I mean, apart from just the adversarial process, but maybe, like, this isn't really related to Wikipedia specifically. I mean, if a juror had brought an encyclopedia and looked up the terms, that would have been against the rules of the court as well, right?
Yeah, it would have.
The reason for that is just because they want the lawyers to be the only source of information for the case, right? Because they don't want the jurors to be biased from any other source.
I mean, the point I...
And why want that?
Yes, I don't think the issue is bias so much as it is just outside information contained the judicial process. You know, if I'm... Mm-hmm. I wish there were a real clear way that I could explain why this is the case. It's just... It's long been held that you don't want the jury to be exposed to information that isn't, you know, given to them through the court system. You know, in the case of Wikipedia, a lot of that information is hearsay. It wouldn't be admissible in court. While an expert could testify to it because, you know, they have knowledge of it, what's on Wikipedia is hearsay, and it wouldn't be admissible. That's the kind of thing.
That's one reason, and also you don't want a juror who has gone home and he's looked something up on his own to come in and then once he is actually back into the jury room, turn to the juror to the left of him and say, well, hey, you know what, I read that stuff about the DNA evidence that we were presented by, you know, the forensics experts on the prosecution side is totally bogus. I, you know, went to the CSI page and they do it completely different. You know, that's just another way that it would start to taint things is that, you know, once that information does get in, it can be shared amongst the jurors, and so now you've got all these problems of stuff that's in that's completely outside the control of both the judge and unless he chooses to sequester the jury members and outside of the control of the attorneys who are presenting the case.
But why is that outside control necessarily bad? I mean, one could certainly see an argument that you have an enterprising jury member who goes forth and does research and actually improves the outcome of the case.
That might be the case, but I mean, I think that is sort of the, like I said before, one of the core components of the legal system is it's intended that the parties who are presenting the case to do it to their best efforts. The burden doesn't fall on the jury member to do that, and it can also affect the process well.
I mean, it'd be something that's be transparency as well, because they suddenly came back and with a, I guess, biased judgment, you know, anybody not in the jury room would have to wonder, well, what happened there? Why did the information come from? It would seem most, that would be my guess why this sort of information is disbarred.
That makes sense. And if someone comes in with certain information before process, then that usually comes up with injury selection. Like, oh yeah, I actually did my PhD thesis on blood spatter radius. And probably they would not put him on the jury.
Right. I mean, and we're talking about Wikipedia here because it popped up in this one case, but you know, it also applies to news reports that have been written about the case that they're, you know, that the jurors are sitting for. And you know, the scientific stuff, I think, is another important part of it. It's probably less of a concern in other ways that a jury can be tainted just by accessing outside sources. Be anything from newspapers, you know, a jury might even see the case on the front of a newspaper. The way to the courthouse, that's a report for jury duty, but, you know, actively going out and looking up information that relates to a case, I think, is pretty problematic.
Right. Similarly with why we don't want jurors to talk about the case outside of the courtroom and then later the jury room is because we don't want the jurors to have preconceived notions about how they are going to interpret certain evidence or how they're going to rule in the case before it's actually time for them to sit down and deliberate with the other jurors. If we give them an opportunity to talk about it with other people or other jurors, you know, it could start to tweak their view of it, especially with relation to each other, before all of the evidence is heard. Which goes to that
right.
Second question about why they shouldn't friend each other on Facebook.
Yeah, an interesting thing about jury deliberations and how jurors interact in the deliberation room or the jury room when they're on recess is that things that they do when they're talking to each other happens in front of all the members of the jury at that given moment. And once you get outside the courthouse or even just the courtroom, you lose that sort of transparency between jury members, I think. And so if two people start talking about the case and then, you know, something comes up and they say, well, I thought this, and then, you know, one juror is able to convince, you know, the juror that she met from sitting on the trial outside of the courthouse, then you've got this outside influence which has now affected the opinion of another jury member when it's supposed to be a little bit more independent than that. Dominic, any thoughts on communications outside of the courthouse?
I think we've covered it pretty well.
Yeah, my only thought would be that friending somebody on Facebook is less invidious than having an actual conversation about it, about the case with a juror outside of the jury room.
It bothers me because it implies that she intended to communicate outside of the courthouse. Much less than it was an actual communication.
I don't know. I've got a lot of friends on Facebook, the vast majority with whom I do not communicate with on any type of regular basis.
Well, now and it wasn't just two people that had friended each other from.
It was five of the jurors, right?
Five jurors, that's correct. And I don't know how many jurors were actually sitting for this case, though.
Yeah, it could have been anywhere from 6 to 12 or 14.
Right.
I mean, to me, it seems like it could be as innocent as, you know, asking a fellow juror's name and occupation. Like, I mean, that is the one level that people friend each other on Facebook. It's just a, you know, sort of get the basic information and then never use it again kind of interaction. But I also see the capability for it to be a much larger, much more interactive thing, which I'm sure what the attorneys were fearing.
So, you know, the other interesting component of this story was the fact that the judge had specifically charged them with not communicating with each other, and for whatever reason, they still went ahead and friended each other on Facebook. Maybe that was because they didn't think that friending was an actual communication that would violate that judge's order. Maybe they forgot about it. Maybe they just didn't care and completely defied his order. But in any event, I think these attorneys in the case are trying to... I think they're trying to get a new trial out of this when they figure that out. I would be really interested to hear how the attorneys figured out in the case that the jurors were Facebooking each other. That's another interesting question, I guess.
Yeah, because my guess is the lawyers were not friends of the jurors on Facebook.
Oh, one would hope not, right?
Yeah, one thing that I don't think people realize is that lawyers are not allowed to have even de minimis contact with jurors, and that means, you know, absolutely, we cannot have any contact with jurors. If you see a juror on the side of the street, you're not even supposed to wave to them or say hi. You're supposed to have absolutely no contact with a juror in a case outside of the courtroom.
You don't want any appearances of impropriety as an attorney for on the basis of the rules of professional conduct. So, unless there's any final thoughts on this, I think we can move on to the next story. And that is SciStar, which is back in our story list again. The SciStar v. Apple case, at least the California one, is back in our story list again. This case seems like it'll never end. It's been going on now. If you've been listening, you've probably heard us talk about it several times. It's been going on now for nearly 2 years, at least the events have. And this, again, relates back to this little company in Florida called SciStar, which announced back in April of 2007 that they were going to commercialize a non-Apple hardware computer, which ran a version of Apple's operating system, OS X. And in the process, they were defying the end-user license agreement, which Apple distributes with all of its retail versions of operating systems. And within the EULA, the end-user license agreement, it specified that licensees were not allowed to operate the operating system on non-Apple labeled hardware, and it also prohibited modification of the copyrighted files and other portions of the operating system. Eventually, and to sort of summarize this more quickly, what ended up happening was Apple sued SciStar, and there were issues about whether or not the EULA was enforceable. And then a second suit had stemmed out of the first suit. The first suit was in California. The second one, which is still ongoing, is down in Florida. And recently, the other month, we talked about this in the show, in California, Apple had filed for a motion for summary judgment. They won that motion, and the court found that SciStar was liable on issues of copyright under the DMCA, which included the distribution of the modified copies of Apple's operating system with those non-Apple computers, and additionally contributory infringement for encouraging customers to violate the license agreement, as well as the copyrights which were at issue. And finally, at the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA and trafficking in devices which were used to circumvent the copyright protection, which was embodied on the DVDs of which contained the operating system. So what ended up happening out of this is we had a stipulated agreement which came down after the summary judgment, and it basically worked as a settlement. And I believe that SciStar agreed to pay $1,337 in damages or so. I'm sorry, that's $1,337,000. And then an additional $1,337,000 in attorney's fees as well to Apple. Now what has happened is Apple had requested a permanent injunction, and we saw an opinion come out this week on the permanent injunction. So I think that brings us up to speed. Does any of you guys want to talk a little bit about the permanent injunction and what happened in it?
Yeah, sure. So essentially, preliminary injunctions are not automatically granted. You have to show four things. First of all, that if there isn't a permanent injunction, Apple, in this case, would suffer irreparable harm. You need to show that there aren't adequate legal remedies, so just collecting more money from SciStar wouldn't be sufficient. You have to balance whether or not this is – it's called balancing the hardships. You look at Apple's position and SciStar's position, and you see who's worse off if you put in the injunction. And then you finally look at the effect on the public interest. And the judge pretty much found that all of these factors weighed in favor of Apple. First off, that Apple would suffer irreparable harm, especially to its brand, if SciStar kept distributing these versions of OS X. Secondly, that there was irreparable harm. I'm sorry, that there weren't adequate legal remedies. First of all, because it was unclear as to whether or not SciStar had enough money to pay the current damages that it's supposed to pay. And secondly, that there would just be continuing harm that would come to Apple as a result of this. Balancing the hardships, the judge very conclusory basically said, Apple's going to be in it's harder on Apple if they continue to sell this than it is on SciStar if we ban SciStar from selling it.
Right. So just to back up for a second, Apple actually specifically asked for a number of things to impose in the permanent injunction against SciStar, and that included the manufacturing and distributing any version of OS X which was prepared as a derivative work or any kind of modification. And they also asked to, of course, have SciStar stop creating tools which would be used to circumvent any of the copyright protection software that was embodied on those DVDs or within the operating system itself, and as well as possessing any of that. And so they wanted to stop them from not only issuing or selling these computers which have OS X preloaded on it, they also wanted to stop them from using this particular tool which was being used to circumvent or it being used to get the OS X onto the computers themselves. So SciStar did something interesting here too in the reply to Apple's motion, and that was they didn't argue against it really, at least not in full. And do you have any thoughts on why that might have been interesting, Ben?
What do you mean that they didn't argue against it in full? Can you elaborate?
Well, sure. Actually, the judge made it very clear within the first couple paragraphs of their analysis, and they said that basically SciStar didn't argue against any of those factors that are supposed to be considered in light of a permanent injunction. And instead, what they actually argued was that if they said very explicitly that if this court is to impose any permanent injunction in this case, it should not extend to Snow Leopard. And Snow Leopard, of course, is the separate version. It is just a new iteration, basically, of OS X.
Right. So Apple had tried very hard to keep Snow Leopard out of this litigation. They said, you know, so the litigation started before Snow Leopard was released. So Apple didn't want to have any discovery done on Snow Leopard. They didn't want any of the details to be released in this case before Snow Leopard came out. As a result, SciStar filed another litigation that's still ongoing in Florida. In this case, SciStar essentially conceded that there would be an injunction against the old version of OS X, OS 10.5, which was just called plain old regular Leopard, but said, "But you know, fine, grant that injunction, but don't grant the injunction as to 10.6 Snow Leopard or Rebel EFI, which is the something that they were selling that allows people to install OS X on non-Apple computers."
Right, and the court had actually indicated, so those were two separate things. You had the Snow Leopard issue, and then you had this Rebel EFI issue. And the Rebel EFI, that was one, it was basically a derivative of one of the tools that they were using to get OS X onto non-Apple labeled computers, basically. And the court, interestingly, said that SciStar has made it abundantly clear in numerous versions of its oral arguments that they intended to continue to sell Rebel EFI even after, you know, this case had basically been disposed of. And so I think that was a chief concern. So it was really interesting to me that SciStar didn't really argue against the permanent injunction at all. They just argued against the extension of the permanent injunction to Snow Leopard, which is still ongoing in the Florida litigation, of course. But it's interesting to me, though. I mean, would you really even have to discuss it at all as a judge of whether or not you need to include it in a permanent injunction? You know, I think the judge sort of struggled with that a little bit too, and he's like, you know, as long as it is a portion of any of the copyrighted works which are at issue in this case, you can consider it to be part of this injunction, basically.
Right.
He kind of made it. Or go ahead, Ben.
Yes, he did say that, but he also said, you know, we're going to include Rebel EFI for now, but we're going to give SciStar the ability to come back and, you know, explain to us how the Rebel EFI doesn't infringe on copyrights while your old software did. So he left that open. And actually, if you go to SciStar's website now, they have two things listed for sale. One's the Rebel EFI, but it says out of stock, and the other is a T-shirt. So it looks like SciStar, at least for now, is going to continue to try to sell the Rebel EFI, and then eventually, if they can, you know, work it out, begin reselling computers with 10.6.
Actually, the injunction, I don't think, becomes effective until December 31st.
It does, so. But that's true. So they have to comply by December 31st, but they've clearly complied before then. because the last thing you want to do is make, you know, make it look like you're stonewalling and trying to, you know, wiggle your way around this stuff.
Right.
And they'd still be liable in damages for any infringement that happened between then and then, between, you know, today's date and December 31st.
The judge kind of made an example for trying to have it both ways with regard to Snow Leopard, right? In that,
yes.
Before, like, why? I guess I don't understand why the judge is making that big. In that, before Snow Leopard came out, Apple obviously wanted to keep it secret and keep everything quiet about it. And then after it came out, they wanted to protect it. I don't see why that the judge didn't like that.
Because Apple didn't allow any discovery, and now they want. So Apple absolutely stonewalled discovery with regard to Snow Leopard. And
then right, because it's unreleased software. They don't want to give it to their competitors.
They could have released it under seal. There's no... Your argument against that is absurd, Dominic.
but, so, I mean, you can certainly see Apple saying that... You see why they did that, considering their culture of secrecy. Like, even if they released it under seal, they might be leaked.
Yeah, and that would, that's true. And, you know, that would have sucked. But the... corollary to that is once it's released, you shouldn't go around saying, well, you absolutely have to issue an injunction for that topic, which there's nothing in discovery, which we haven't talked about, which in fact we expressly just tried to keep out of litigation to this point.
You
don't see how that's unfair?
No, I see. Okay. Because there was no basis, basically.
Yeah, there's nothing in evidence about whether or not even Systar's software infringed that copyright with regard to 10.6.
So another quick point in this case was the fact that Systar had filed for bankruptcy, I think, early in the summer or so, and everyone sort of questioned whether or not they were going to continue to go ahead with the case, because how are they going to pay their attorney's fees and everything. The judge, interestingly, brings up in this opinion that it was a little bit unclear whether Systar would even be willing to pay any of the monetary damage that they had stipulated to in the settlement. So he discussed that in light of, in favor of issuing a permanent injunction in this case. Did you guys have any final thoughts on this before we move on?
That's why they're still selling T-shirts, is to get the attorney's fees together.
I knew it.
This is an alternative business model that other industries should consider.
Selling T-shirts to pay stipulated agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've nailed this one down pretty good. You know, this is just another extension of the story, which goes on and on. I'm sure there's going to be some new stuff to talk about as the Florida case continues on slowly, of course. So our final story of the day is an interesting one, and it actually is based on a decision which came down from the Ohio Supreme Court. And what had happened, this was based on a criminal action in a case called the State of Ohio v. Smith. And what had happened was, just to quickly recap the facts here, this woman went into a hospital after a drug overdose. I think it was cocaine or crack cocaine or something. And while she was recovering, I guess, at the hospital from the overdose, police came forward, the Ohio State Police came forward and questioned her, and she eventually agreed to call her dealer and arrange for a sale later at her house. And I guess that whole call was recorded. And later the dealer at issue, which I believe was eventually the defendant, Smith, did in fact show up to her house to make a sale, and he was arrested. And while he was arrested, his cell phone was confiscated as well. And there was no warrant that was ever issued for the confiscation of his cell phone. No consent was ever given by this defendant, Smith. And when this finally came up to trial, the trial court had permitted call records and phone numbers, which had been contained within the cell phone itself, to be included within trial testimony. But I think there was actually some photographs that were also found on the cell phone, which were not allowed to go into the trial testimony. So this is sort of an interesting area, because we don't often talk about criminal actions, or at least we might have like once or twice before, about what happens in search and seizure and how it all sort of functions together. How does the Fourth Amendment work and stuff? And of course, you know, what are the exceptions to when you need a warrant, and you know, the times when you don't need a warrant. So does one of you want to just kind of start us off and talk a little bit about search and seizure? Just a quick overview.
Yeah, this is typically my area, so I'll tackle it if nobody has any
objections. I didn't want to put your name in there, but I was like...
Before we dive in, though, can we sort of put this in context? I guess this is an Ohio Supreme Court making a decision, so this is binding in Ohio, but they're using the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution?
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a state court that's making a decision based on federal law, and state courts can do that, but anyway. So essentially... there's something called a search incident to arrest, and search incidents to arrest are an exception to the warrant requirement. So the general requirement for Fourth Amendment law is that if you're going to do a search or a seizure, if you're going to search a place or arrest somebody, you need a warrant. There are lots and lots and lots of exceptions. One of these is, as I was saying, search incident to arrest. When somebody is being arrested, you're allowed to search the person, and the justification for that is... for the safety of the officers and for if you're worried about evidence being destroyed. One case came out, I forget what the first search incident to arrest case was, but then a subsequent case came out called Robinson, and the court in Ohio spends a lot of time talking about Robinson. What happened in Robinson was police arrested a guy, they patted him down, and they found a cigarette. A box of cigarettes on him. They took the box of cigarettes out off of him, opened it up, looked in, and found drugs. The argument that the defendant made in Robinson was essentially, one, there is no evidence there is nothing that would lead you to believe that there is evidence in there that would be destroyed, and there is nothing in there that would lead you to believe that there is something dangerous. You know, there's no way I could have a gun in there or a knife of any, you know, real size. The Supreme Court said that doesn't matter. A search incident to arrest means that they can frisk you, they can take out closed containers, and they can look in closed containers. And that's been federal law since then. The law varies, though, from state to state. In Massachusetts, you can only do a search incident to arrest if you're looking for evidence of the crime for which you're arresting a person. So, again, that's not the law. That's the law federally everywhere, but state law varies from place to place.
Right, so the decisions which have come down from the Supreme Court certainly function as limiting on how far a state can go, or at least or how far the police can go in terms of what they can search and eventually seize and admit into evidence during a trial. I think that's probably safe to say, right?
So I think the best way to look at it is the Supreme Court sets a floor, you know, saying that you can't go any lower than this floor. These are the minimum federal requirements that you guys have to observe. And you guys can either continue to use that floor, or you can interpret your state constitutions to raise that a little bit and say that you have to give more respect to people's privacy rights than the Fourth Amendment does. And there are lots and lots of states that just use, you know, say, we're just going to use the Fourth Amendment, or we're going to interpret our state constitution to be totally consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And there are a handful of states that say our constitution gives more protection to people's privacy interests than the Fourth Amendment does.
Right. So in the Robinson case that you were discussing, which, again, the Ohio Supreme Court goes at length discussing, I think what we could say the toke ruling which came out of that is that you can have a search and seizure of any article or container which is on a defendant's person, as long as this is done in a search into arrest, or if I find the item or the container in accordance with established inventory procedures once the person goes either to the police station and is checked in into the jail there, or if they do that beforehand as they put them into the car or whatever. I think
just to be clear for a second, so the two cases for the search incident to arrest is one for the safety of the officers, so, you know, patting them down for a gun or something like that, right?
Right.
Right.
And the second case is for the preservation of evidence. So just... from my own knowledge, what would an example of that be?
Well, great, great question. Because I mean, that's something they discussed in this case, and that's like the one thing that the prosecution had argued was that if they had not immediately seized the phone and recorded all the data that was on the phone, the defendant might have had a chance to delete all of the call records and all of the phone numbers which were in the phone. Right. So that'd be an incident where you could have a person completely delete or erase the evidence, which was incriminating.
Right. A more grounded example would be if this guy were, he was arrested for being a drug dealer, you pat him down, you find the drugs, and you seize the drugs and you keep him safe. Because if you don't do that, there's a good chance that, you know, he's going to try to get rid of the drugs, because the drugs are very incriminating when you're arrested for, you know, drug charges.
So we sort of delved off here into this huge world that involves search and seizure law, and we don't need to get that deep into it to discuss the more interesting things, at least to me, and that's cell phones are different than a pack of cigarettes. They're very personal devices. They have a lot of personal information on them. If it's just a basic cell phone, it's got at least call records and some sort of phone book attached to it, so people's names, sometimes their addresses, phone numbers. Some, you know, a lot of basic phones these days also have a camera function. But smartphones are different because they contain email, they can contain video, they might contain web browsing history and stuff. What did the court say about what is this like to the a search incident to arrest where you have a container that's at issue? And what did you guys think about it?
It was kind of interesting. So what I think is more interesting in this case, and we'll get to this later, is that there was a dissent in this case. So it was a 4-3 opinion. And the majority opinion basically said that, you know, there's a significant... cell phones fall somewhere between an address book, which, you know, we'll admit that you can search incident to arrest, and a laptop, which you can't search incident to arrest. Even if the person has that laptop on their person. Your privacy interest falls somewhere between those two. What the dissent said was that we think that the, you know, majority has gone too far in saying that, you know, police officers are going to have to make a determination as to, you know, what the storage capacity of this phone is, and, you know, how smart a phone it is, and whether or not it falls closer to the address book or the laptop. I didn't get that from the majority opinion. From the majority opinion, I just got that cell phones have changed over the years, they're more complicated, and the new Brightline rule is you cannot go into somebody's cell phone when they're arrested. You can't start digging through it.
Right, and I think the majority had even discussed that they were wary of imposing some sort of requirement on officers to figure out exactly what the functions of a cell phone were before they went ahead and searched it, and you've got, you know, a bunch of evidentiary concerns there. I mean, are the officers qualified to make those determinations, especially with new phones that come out and stuff? So, you know, I think that they felt that, you know, imposing some sort of standard between distinguishing a smartphone from just a conventional phone just didn't make sense.
At the same time, though, they wanted something that would work for the ages, or at least for the next decade or so, and they figured that since cell phones are going to be only advancing technologically, it's more and more likely that more and more phones will fall into that smart quote-unquote category. So they just did the blanket prohibition.
There was an interesting discussion also in the case which talked about how 1990s federal courts had handled pagers, and a lot of them had actually likened them and other electronic devices to containers, at least in the sense that... Closed containers in the sense that the Supreme Court discussed them in that case. But they really felt that cell phones were different, though, in this case. I was a little bit surprised to see that and a little bit glad to see that, too, because it seems like they understand some of the issues that, you know, revolve around privacy and the information that gets stored on a phone. So it appeared to at least be a good forward step for the way that cell phone data is treated. Do you guys have any sense on how other courts treat cell phones in other states, or if there are any other opinions on it at all?
I think some other states have found that cell phones are no different than other closed containers. There was actually a research article about it, I want to say last year, that got posted on Slashdot, of all places, that basically went the path of the dissent and said, under current federal law, there's pretty much no question that people would be able to root through your iPhone or your smartphone and get whatever information they wanted off of it as part of a search incident to arrest.
Here's a puzzling question for you. Say that we're in a jurisdiction where the police can indeed search through your phone, and say that your phone is encrypted. Do you have to tell them how to open it?
That's a whole other line of cases as to whether or not telling them the password would constitute self-incrimination.
Consent?
Yeah. No, self-incrimination. Because if you tell them the password, that implies ownership. And ownership, if they can show ownership, that means that they can use that against you in a court. However, if you deny that you know the password, they can't get into it, presumably, and they can't use any information that they find against you.
But isn't there something about consent in searches? Like, I seem to recall reading somewhere that if a police officer asks someone, would you mind if we searched your trunk, for example, and the driver says, oh, sure, go ahead, then they've given consent and they no longer require a warrant?
That's correct. Consent is one of the exceptions to the warrant requirement.
So are you suggesting that giving a password that would unlock an encrypted device would then be some form of consent?
Yes, I think it would, but yes. I think Ben correctly identifies that the actual issue is self-incrimination, not consent.
Yeah, though giving a password would definitely be consent.
It's tangential in that sense.
What if you were required by law, though, to give a password? Just for a moment, think that there's some law that requires you to do that, and for whatever reason it was enforceable.
That would seem a violation of something or other.
It would. I mean, could you then say that in some crazy sense that it's not actually consent even though you give the password?
Sure, you could say that.
I mean, it's like consenting without actually consenting. Like, I'll give you the password, but I'm not actually consenting to you going through my phone.
I could certainly see someone trying to make that argument. I'm not sure how successful it would be.
Yeah. I mean, I could think of some circumstances under which it might be successful, or...
I think you'd be safer just not giving the password and seeing what happens then.
Yeah.
And probably trying to overturn the law. But that is, of course, not legal advice, and if you find yourself in a situation...
Well, I mean, to me it seems vaguely analogous to the situation of the sysadmin out in California. Mm-hmm. I mean, giving the password away. I mean, him holding on to the password was problemsome for him, so I don't know.
Yeah, that's a weird case. And just to clue in the readers, we're talking about the Terry Childs case, and if you do a search for Terry Childs on our site, you'll come up with a couple articles, and I think Podcast 19, which was the last time we talked about him. But Dave,
and it's actually I was just going to say it was Childs on that. There's a blog post sitting on the front of our page right now on the website.
Yeah, his trial just started.
Right. So, do you guys have any final thoughts on this ruling that came down from Ohio? I mean, I guess it'd be helpful to just reiterate one time that, you know, obviously a decision of the Ohio Supreme Court does not affect any other courts in the United States necessarily, but, you know, they could certainly find them persuasive to similar arguments should they pop up. As far as I know, I don't think we have a Supreme Court decision, obviously, on privacy in cellular phones or the data that's contained on them, right?
Not yet, as far as I know.
All right, so did you guys have any other thoughts before we tie it off for this week?
I just wanted to kind of go into the closed container thing. Like, that would be mostly for safety reasons, like, right, if someone has something hidden in their briefcase, like a bomb or a AK-47, I don't see how a cell phone or even a pager back in the day would have been a closed container in that sense. It's not like, I guess they were kind of bulky, but it wasn't.
I think it's a tenuous argument to equate the two, but it's one that's been made over and over again. Okay. I mean, if you can search inside of a box of cigarettes for no other reason than you arrested the person, what's to say that you can't also search a cell phone just because you arrested the person?
I see your point. But cell phones are different than cigarettes.
Yeah, they are. I don't disagree with that, but there are certainly courts that do.
I mean, the thing that I always struggle with is like a cigarette pack or a cigarette box is it's a physical container that you can fit things into. You could fit things into cell phones like that, but they're not really talking about the data that's on. Once we're talking about the space that's in between the circuitry and any of the IC components that sit on the board. I suppose one could also say that you could overvolt the batteries on the cell phone and change it into some sort of destructive device, but that's all.
But isn't the argument for it being a container just, you know, that it's making the analogy for it to be a container of all the equivalent things, so it's a container containing an address book, a phone, and, Minesweeper, and therefore, you know, opening it up finds out that those things are in there, or is that just off base?
I think that's the analogous argument. I'm just not sure how applicable it is.
Yeah.
It, you know, another thing that affected this case a bit, too, is I don't know that the data that was on the cell phone was necessary for the prosecution to prove their case. And as they had pointed out, or at least as the court had pointed out, there were no exigent circumstances at issue here where they were seriously concerned about losing the data on the cell phone itself. I mean, remember, as I went over the facts of the case and at the start of the story, they have the call recorded between the defendant and the person in the hospital, and he showed up at the home, and there was, you know, a bunch of other evidence which seriously suggested that it was incriminating circumstances under which he had been arrested. So, you know, I really didn't feel like any of the prosecution's argument really went anywhere with the container argument.
I mean, they could have just taken the cell phone, gotten a warrant through it if they needed that for their case, right? I mean, thus yes, ensuring that the evidence was not destroyed, but just later checking.
I don't think it would have been a problem for them to have seized it pursuant to just, you know, arresting the guy and putting it in inventory and then getting a warrant. That would have been fine.
Yeah, they can, I mean, and if there was any warrant in this case, it totally changed everything. You know, they would then have the right to go through and search to the phone and the data contained therein and use it in trial. But that just simply wasn't the case here. Okay, well, any final thoughts?
I'm good.
Happy holidays.
Thank you for listening to the holiday special of Technically Legal. Thanks again, folks, for listening. Next week, pursuant to all the winter holidays and stuff, I think we're going to take next Sunday off. But we'll try to keep some interesting blog posts up on the site. As always, you know, the stories just keep coming in, even though there's holidays going on. So hopefully there'll be some stuff to read. Well, anyways, thank you for listening again. I was your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me were
Dominic Ramier,
Ben Snitkoff,
and David Liu.
Thanks for listening. You can send any comments to podcast@technicallylegal.org and follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. We'll see you next time.
Happy holidays, and see you next decade.